I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's been a tough year for inhabitants along the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic. Hurricanes Irma and Maria ravaged cities in the Caribbean. And although the winds have died down, the recovery effort is far from over. Today, we'll ask two area relief workers what they witnessed on their recent trips to Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, and how recovery efforts are going in the Caribbean. Then, it's trivia time for Show Me State Know-It-Alls. We'll meet the authors behind a new Missouri almanac, chock full of facts, folk wisdom, and oddities. From famous Missourians to the first Olympics hosted in the United States, to the diverse wildlife found here, there's plenty for everyone to learn. It's on Up to Date, after this hour's news. Sometimes it feels like the world may be moving on already from the devastation wrought by this year's hurricanes, especially in the Caribbean. But that's a luxury that those who live there don't yet have. Many volunteers and aid groups based in Kansas City continue to be part of relief efforts in affected countries, including U.S. territories there, including the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. Joining us this morning to bring us an update on where the recovery effort stands are Mike Euler. He lives in Lee's Summit. He's a volunteer with the American Red Cross, just back from 3 weeks in the Virgin Islands. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
It's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And also Kim Carroll. She's the chief operating officer of Heart to Heart, the Lenexa-based agency that's been following hurricanes in Houston and the Caribbean all season long, it seems like. Kim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
And Kim, let me actually start with you. There are a lot of charities and aid organizations out there. Remind our listeners what Heart to Heart does in general and specifically right now in Puerto Rico.
Absolutely. So Heart to Heart is a Lenexa-based humanitarian aid organization with a focus on healthcare. We deploy medical resources, both volunteers, physicians, nurses, EMTs, as well as medical supplies into disaster areas. So in the case of Puerto Rico, we've been sending physicians, nurses, and supplies to support our own teams, but as well as supplies to support other humanitarian aid organizations. So we have people, but we also maintain a warehouse where donors provide pharmaceuticals, medical supplies, and we distribute those to other organizations that can use them on the ground.
And Puerto Rico, just to remind everyone, that was hit by Hurricane Maria back on September 20th. And I've seen reports that the death toll there is up to 51, still rising because of infections people are getting from the water. How soon did Heart to Heart get to Puerto Rico?
So Heart to Heart actually was one of the first aid organizations on the ground in Puerto Rico. We arrived the morning of the 24th, when we couldn't get in via traditional means such as commercial air, the airstrips in San Juan weren't operating. Our founder and board member, Gary Morsch, who's a physician, and our advanced team actually flew down to Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and we chartered a helicopter, and they flew in via helicopter from Haiti into San Juan and landed in Caguas.
And what did they find when they first got there? Paint the picture for us.
Total destruction. So their helicopter landed in the parking lot of the Mennonite Hospital in Caguas, Puerto Rico, which is about an hour west of San Juan. That hospital had no power, no water. The doors were blown out. The glass was shattered. The staff had been there since the beginning of the storm. They had about, I think it was 111 inpatients. So these are patients that were still so ill they could not be released from the hospital. And the staff was taking care of these folks and had virtually no relief. So Gary immediately took on patient care in the ER. But it was a complete shattered hospital.
You've been down there yourself.
Yes.
When did you get back?
Tuesday morning.
So pretty recently.
Mm-hmm.
How have things changed since those first few days?
The island in total, as you would expect, there are some areas that are improving. The airport was functioning when I left, so I flew out through the San Juan airport. I couldn't get in. When I went in, I couldn't get in through the San Juan airport, but I did fly out through that. So that's an improvement. But the areas where I worked, which were in the mountains and in the central part of the island, haven't really changed much. They don't have power. They don't have running water. The toilets don't flush. They don't have food. They don't have potable water, so the people are drinking runoff water. They don't have access to health care. Our teams are actually making home visits up into the mountains. Every day there are flash flood warnings. Roads are eroding and, in fact, getting worse. So it's still very much a disaster zone.
Was the assumption I stated at the start of our conversation true, that people's attention has wandered away and are just not as interested in what's happening there, even though it's been only a month?
I don't know that I can answer that, because I've been in Puerto Rico. I haven't had cell service or access to internet for 3 weeks, so I'm not sure what the public dialogue has been.
Does heart-to-heart still get good support?
Our support continues, and our supporters are incredibly generous. What we tell people on the ground, we're simply the face of the many people that care and want to help the people of Puerto Rico. It brings tears to their eyes. They just want to know they haven't been forgotten. And so our donors and the people here that have supported our efforts in every different way have made a huge difference every day on the ground.
That's Kim Carroll. She's the COO of Heart to Heart, the Lenexa-based humanitarian group. If you have questions for our guests today who have been on relief trips to the Virgin Islands and to Puerto Rico, or if you've ever volunteered in a disaster area yourself, we'd love to hear from you with what you're thinking as you consider the hurricane damage. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Mike Euler, you are retired now after a long career in law enforcement. You could just be relaxing and enjoying your time at home. Why, a month ago, did you decide to pack up your stuff and spend 3 weeks on an island that had been devastated by a hurricane?
Well, I got involved with the Red Cross a year ago at the VA hospital. I'm a veteran. I served 4 years in the U.S. Army. And through the Red Cross, I started working at the VA hospital. And then I got involved with other things with the Red Cross, the disaster action team. We respond to every fire in the Kansas City area and help people who are displaced. And then I started hearing about what we do overseas with, you know, disasters. I couldn't go to Houston due to some personal dates. I couldn't make it. But when they asked me 3 weeks ago to go to the Virgin Islands, I said, sure.
And how much lead time did you get?
A day. They called me Monday. I flew out on Tuesday morning to Atlanta and then a charter to St. Thomas.
And St. Thomas is in the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Yes, sir.
And where did you spend most of the last 3 weeks?
Well, my first day in St. Thomas, I got reassigned to St. John, which is the smallest of the three Virgin Islands, St. Croix, St. Thomas, and St. John.
And what's St. John like? What was it like before the hurricane?
Well, it's a very small island, only has 6,000 people population-wise, but it's very popular with scuba divers and deep sea fishing, so it's a very attractive tourist location.
A lot of people have homes there, if they're especially wealthier people have homes there.
And so I went there, which I loved, because I got to meet the same people every day for 3 weeks. I brought my vest in to show you that. I wore my vest. It was a magnet. People would come up to me and just ask if I could be hugged.
Yeah. What I'm curious, I mean, we've seen a lot of pictures of devastation. I know that the death toll in the Virgin Islands wasn't as high as it was in Puerto Rico. There was still a lot of widespread damage. What kind of damage did you see when you first got there?
Well, it was two stages. Hurricane Irma did the structural damage with the 250-mile-an-hour winds. And then, of course, Maria came with the 20 inches of rain. So it was a 1-2 punch to the island. I saw agricultural damage. A green island was brown. It was absolutely brown when I arrived there. And even in the 3 weeks I've been there, I've seen the green starting to come back. But the structural damage, houses with no roofs, with no walls. Mudslides blocking the roads, the water, no water, and no electricity. Everything on St. John now is still used by generator, gas fuel generators.
I'm guessing that since you were reassigned even on where you would be as soon as you got down there, you probably didn't know what you would be doing either once you got there.
That's right. They told me that I would be doing a lot of everything, which was very valuable to my career in the Red Cross. Some days I was working in the shelter. Some days I was doing the feeding. We had over 1,000 meals a day that we sent out to the citizens. And then I did the emergency distribution of cleaning supplies, of cases of water. I never thought handing a person a case of water would be so fulfilling.
And why was it fulfilling? What about it?
The water, like Kim said, was contaminated. There was no running water. So they would use the water to brush their teeth, to wash their hair, to drink. It's so hot there. The dehydration level, you have to keep drinking water just to maintain.
Yeah. I'm curious where you stayed and how you lived when the people who lived there were in many cases homeless or hungry. It seems like it must take quite an operation just to shelter and feed those of you who are sheltering and feeding the others.
Right. Well, several of the people on St. Thomas, we stayed on a naval ship for a week or two. I was able to stay in one of the small bread and breakfasts that wasn't damaged severely. Of course, no electricity. We only had the generator would run at night.
Sure.
Just so we could sleep in somewhat cooling conditions.
Yeah, but it was not a luxury vacation by any stretch.
No, sir.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation with Mike Euler, who just got back from 3 weeks in the Virgin Islands, and Kim Carroll, who just got back from Puerto Rico with Heart to Heart. You can join us by calling 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCUR Up to Date. And we have a call from Mike in Overland Park. Hello, Mike.
Hello, how are you today?
Doing well, thanks.
I just came back last Friday from 2 weeks in the Virgin Islands with All Hands, and I'd been in Houston for 2 weeks with All Hands before that. A couple of things. First of all, regarding the Red Cross, they were doing yeoman's work down there, and I was probably shipmates on the right. With Mr. Euler. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that came about was in talking to some of the state troopers from New Jersey who were down there is people on the mainland don't know how long it will take for this recovery. There are people in New Jersey that are just now getting back in their homes from Sandy, and this is a long-haul commitment. The other is how forgotten the people of the Virgin Islands felt when all of the news is only about Puerto Rico, just because that's where the news talks about. But the one thing that you come away with is how thankful the people are that someone is there to help them. And it was really a great experience, although when you leave, you realize how much work there is to do, and therefore, a lot of us will be going back.
Yeah, I was just
so
going to ask.
My experience.
When do you think you'll go back, Mike?
Well, there's certain little life events that have to happen here. But
sure.
Right now, I'm going to be taking a crew of 15 down to Houston in November, and then I will be trying to get back to the Virgin Islands. My crew was doing tarping, which becomes problematic if there's nothing to tarp against when the roof has been moved three blocks away. It's hard to tarp on top of the roof.
Yeah.
But I'll probably be going back most likely in January.
Mike, thank you so much for your service to the folks of the Virgin Islands and for calling in today.
No problem. And thanks to the folks that your guests are who have done a lot of service themselves.
I appreciate that. Thanks so much. And Mike Euler, our caller Mike, described a scene where they're a long way from a full recovery.
Yes, they are. I mean, we're starting to get them water and food, but the sheltering part, the structural of the residences is just going to take time. Mike mentioned the tarps. You know, FEMA has their Blue Roof program where they're putting these large roof tarps on residences. What the Red Cross did, we had smaller tarps. Sometimes people maybe had a roof, but they had no windows.
Mm-hmm.
So the smaller tarps also were very useful for the citizens of St. John and St. Thomas.
Kim Carroll, back over in Puerto Rico, where your organization does primarily medical work, what kinds of medical situations were you encountering now after the immediate aftermath of the hurricane in the weeks afterward?
A lot of what we see are the challenges of access. Most of the clinics, and we're working with the ASPPR, which is essentially the Free Clinic Association. It's the federally qualified health care system clinics. They're struggling to get back up and operational and serve people, but many of the constituents that they serve also have trouble simply getting access. So we do a lot of home visits. Our teams hike in. We've been working in remote areas in Utuado, Adjuntas, Jayuya, where we actually collaborate with the local guard and we'll go out with the Puerto Rican National Guard and make home care visits. They need access to their medication. Chronic conditions like diabetes and hypertension are exacerbated and become problematic when these patients can't get access to their meds. So we do a lot of home visits.
And are those meds, I know that, as you mentioned, you were able to fly out of San Juan. Obviously, mm-hmm. that's also a tourist area. It's probably going to be among the first that should see recovery. Are people able to get to those places to get their meds, or is this just completely out of their reach at this moment?
Well, most people live – Puerto Rico is a fairly large island, so for many people, just simply getting 2 kilometers down the side of the mountain is impossible. So what is happening right now, the lack of communication is a major problem. The pharmacies are starting to get their medications, but they actually have to handwrite their orders and courier them in. There is no electronic communication. There's no internet. So everything is done by hand and old-fashioned courier process. Same thing with medications.
And our caller mentioned that he was with a different organization, although he may have stayed on the same ship where some of the Red Cross volunteers did. Kim, Heart to Heart is just one of the many organizations mm-hmm. involved. How closely do all these organizations work together? Is the system working?
I can say in Puerto Rico, there's a lot of collaboration. None of us work alone. Within San Juan proper, there are representatives who collaborate and who share information. So every day, to the extent that we could communicate, and we use satellite phones and some other Garmin technology that helped us send texts via satellite, we would share what we saw on the ground. And all of that is shared across organization. So we're only as good as we can collaborate, and we work with everybody.
Yeah.
Either through distribution of supplies or sharing human resources.
True for the Red Cross as well.
And Brian, Mike? I saw that too on St. John with the Salvation Army, with FEMA. We coordinated my last day there. I coordinated with FEMA. They were delivering an 18-wheeler with non-perishable food. And they came right to me to ask me, where do you want this parked? And we worked with the Salvation Army. Maybe they'd take one half of an apartment building. I would take the other half. So mm-hmm. I saw a lot of talk. People really were working together, the first responders.
You know, I don't want this to seem like a political question, but we in the news coverage of the early relief effort saw a lot of the back and forth between local elected leaders, the mayor of San Juan, the governor of Puerto Rico, with U.S. federal government officials, even with the president. When you're out in the countryside working with the people, are they concerned with the politics? I can't imagine they're able to follow much in the way of American news coverage. What is their attitude toward the American government's response to what's been happening there, Mike?
You know, Brian, they just wanted water. They just wanted Clorox. They just wanted cleaning supplies. I didn't have one political talk in 3 weeks. They just want to get back on their feet and get back to a normal life.
Yeah, I would agree. There's no politics on the ground. When you need clean water and you need medicine and you need food, politics were irrelevant.
Kim, I know we asked you this last time you were here, but I'm going to ask it again. What mm-hmm. can people here do if they want to be supporting the efforts on the ground that your organization is doing?
If they want to support Heart to Heart, the best thing to do is to support us financially. Financial resources help us get the resources needed faster to the people on the ground in Puerto Rico. And that's to go to our website, hearttoheart.org, and donate. We can get people there faster. We can get medicines there faster through financial donations.
And Mike, can anyone volunteer with the American Red Cross?
Well, you go to our website and you ask to be a volunteer. We do background checks to make sure that you're able physically and mentally to do some of the things that we do. But again, monetary donations and something as small as $5. $5 will buy two cases of water, which will get a family through a week on St. John.
Wow, that little bit can make a big difference.
Yes, sir.
So, Kim, will you be going back with Heart to Heart?
Probably. I don't know exactly when, but I spent 3 weeks in Texas, came home for a week, went down to Puerto Rico. I've been home for a few days. I'm sure I'm going back, but they'll let me know. You know, we'll know that hopefully with a 24-hour lead time.
And Mike, do you have the bug? Are you gonna need to go back?
If my wife lets me, I'd love to go back. I'd like to go back tomorrow, but you know, I would like to go back in at least the next 2 months.
Why is that? I mean, you're not getting paid. What are you getting out of this?
Hugs. Hugs and taking care of people. That's the part I missed in my other career. Didn't get hugged much in my other career. But it just...
Yeah, law enforcement.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
But working at the VA hospital, I see just coming and visiting a patient for 30 seconds, but just giving someone a case of water in Eastern St. John on a dirt road, I mean, there's nothing to describe the feeling you get when you just hand a case of water to someone and just see their eyes teared up. You can't pay for that.
Most of our organizations are going to be on the ground for a long time. The recovery in Puerto Rico is not going to happen in the next few weeks. So the more we can help the people there over time, it's just the right thing to do.
That's Kim Carroll. She's the Chief Operating Officer of Heart to Heart International. We're also joined this morning by Mike Euler, who is a volunteer with the American Red Cross. To both of you, thank you for all you're doing, and thank you for being here today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we may not have hurricanes in Missouri, but we've got earthquakes and tornadoes and art and architecture and a whole treasure trove of fun facts. A new almanac packages up the Show Me State for kids to learn and enjoy, and we'll talk to some of its authors. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we learned what life was like for a young American serviceman in World War I through the letters he sent back home. Also, we talked with Mexico's ambassador to the United States about tending to international relations in the Trump age. You can find that conversation at kcur.org. And don't forget to join us on Monday. Steve will be back, and he'll speak with lawyer-turned-best-selling author John Grisham about his latest legal thriller. But today, did you know that the same city in Missouri holds the record for the lowest temperature ever recorded in the state and the highest? Okay, did you know that the first Olympic Games held in the United States were in Missouri? Did you know there's a new almanac out loaded with facts and lists and many, many pictures that tell the story of the Show Me State in a way that kids and more than a few adults are probably going to find fascinating and fun? It's called the Missouri Almanac 2018 and 19, and three of the authors who worked on it are here to talk about not only the book, but about how to cram a big state into one little book. Andrea Sumi, welcome to you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So what parts of this book did you work on?
I worked on the educational consulting part and advised the authors, and we kind of talked through what would students in Missouri benefit from, what would teachers like, and what maybe the high interest piece is trying to grab their attention.
All right. And Carolyn Miller is here. Hello, Carolyn.
Hi.
What parts of this book did you work on?
So I worked on animals, the farm, and the outdoors.
All right. And Tracy Angel, good morning.
Good morning.
What did you do?
I put together the sections science and technology, history and mystery, and the arts and architecture.
Can't wait to hear about the mystery part of this. In fact, Tracy, let me start with you. What do you do when you're not being an education consultant for almanacs?
Okay. I I have a variety of jobs and literary, I guess, interests. I teach two sections of mass communication at UMKC, and I'm a freelance writer and author and journalist as well. I write for The Pitch regularly, and these books for Reedy Press.
Okay. Have you ever worked on an almanac before?
I have not.
Why did you now?
Okay. Well, like Carolyn, I'm a published author with this independent press, Reedy Press, in St. Louis. And so a few years back, Josh Stevens, the publisher, had this idea to bring Carolyn's in St. Louis, and I'm here in Kansas City, grew up in mid-Missouri, bring all of our interests and highlight all of these things in the great state of Missouri into one place and, you know, bring authors from across the state as well on board to research and write it.
So for people who cannot actually see the book that we all have a copy of in front of us, why don't you describe it? What would they see if they see this book?
This book, I think they would see it as this incredible and an interesting reference.
It's kind of a coffee table sized book. It's got a lot of glossy colored pages.
Right. But as a young person, you would open it up and you would see these illustrations and the script and the pictures that kind of pull you in and engage you, as well as purposefully the short bits of information so that they can retain the information, and it's written hopefully in an interesting way to help them learn and to just know more about Missouri.
Yeah. Carolyn, I understand that in real life, when you're not writing almanac chapters, you're a zookeeper?
I am, so that's why naturally I got the animals and the outdoor sections.
Where are you a zookeeper?
So I work at the St. Louis Zoo. I'm a carnivore keeper there, so I get to take care of everything with sharp teeth, the big cats and the bears and all of those animals. So working on the animal section was obviously a natural fit for me and something that was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah. How do you get involved in writing an almanac? This doesn't seem like a consistent with your day-to-day work.
So I just kind of have a funny life story, I guess. I was actually a creative writing major in college, and I graduated and just kind of fell into this job as a zookeeper. I'd been working at the St. Louis Zoo since I was in high school. I've always loved animals. And so my first book was actually, with Reedy Press, along with Tracy here. And I wrote it about an animal I was taking care of in the children's zoo at the time. And so that's kind of how I got my foot into the world of being an author. And since then, the Almanac's actually my sixth book that I've worked worked on with Reedy Press. So it was just kind of a natural fit.
Carolyn's from St. Louis, but Andrea, you work with the Liberty School District, right?
I do. I'm the library media director for Liberty.
Now, one of the things that I'm struck by with school libraries these days when I happen to walk into one is that in some ways they aren't so much about the books as they used to be.
Exactly. We're evolving, as always. Libraries are evolving to meet patrons' needs. And so you might hear the term makerspace. You might hear learning commons. There are some really amazing things going on that are typically in school libraries. They're student-driven and teacher-driven, things that students need to find and do to create.
And yet here you are taking the very old-fashioned route of putting out a book, and not just a book, but even a very old-fashioned kind of book, an almanac.
Exactly. Excuse me. You might be surprised, but maybe not. Students are really interested in visual kinds of things, pictures, short text. So think of Guinness Book of World Records, Ripley's Believe It or Not, those types of text. And that's really kind of what you're going to see in the almanac. So it can be a great situation for kids. And a lot of students really love print.
Well, I'm just going to say, even all of those examples and also the almanac. So I was kind of a nerdy kid, I'm just going to be honest. And I loved those books when I was a kid. But they didn't look like this. The Guinness Book of World Records was mostly, it had some pictures, but it was black and white.
You might be surprised at what it looks like now. It's very visual. There are lots of images.
And so with this almanac, how does it function in a learning environment like a school? Would you imagine teachers using this with their classes?
I think so. I think the content provides a really great opportunity in. It's definitely not a textbook, but it provides just that into what things that students might be interested in, but also the things that teachers are trying to get across. So I think of the biography section for sure is aligned to Missouri learning standards, just in some of the science, the climate, that kind of thing, and the social studies pieces.
I'm curious what that means, aligned to Missouri's learning standards.
So educators across the state and across the nation are always thinking about what do our students need to know when they leave us? What experiences do they need to have? And so those are the things I'm talking about. There's definitely guidance that that we have to follow, and the almanac is closely aligned.
All right. Well, I want to ask all of you about some of these fun facts in this book, because I mentioned earlier, for example, that the same city in Missouri has the lowest recorded temperature in the state and the highest. Tracy, what city is it? Oh, it's a stumper.
Is that Warsaw?
Yes, Warsaw, Missouri, down by Lake of the Ozarks. Kind of an incredible. I know. I've always wanted to be a game show host. It was recorded at 40 degrees below zero in February of 1905 and 118 degrees in July of 1954.
Wow.
Yeah. How do you guys find out these fun facts? How did you do the research for this book, Tracy?
Well, as I had mentioned earlier, that I had certain sections I was charged with writing and researching. So for arts and architecture, science and technology, you just, you know, as you would start any book or research project, try to find, you know, your internet and then verify the source. But I used a lot from like the Missouri History Museum and the State Archives when we were finding images or, you know, backing up dates or making sure everything was accurate. You know, of course, as I teach, you know, responsible and finding credible sources as well, you know, making sure that we could have more than one reference for each entry.
What's the favorite thing of yours that you included in the art and architecture section?
I knew you were going to ask. And arts and architecture. You know, the Frank Lloyd Wright, I'm not necessarily what I would think like an artistic person, but I appreciate it. And so just knowing that you can go and visit some of the homes that, you know, he had designed right here in Kansas City, as well as the St. Louis area.
There are five mm-hmm. Frank Lloyd Wright homes in Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So that was a pretty cool. And then, of course, I mean, there's things we take so much for granted, like the arch. I mean, yeah, to people who aren't from Missouri or St. Louis area, you know, it's wow, it's breathtaking. And then so just to think about the design of that and, you know, how big it was.
Carolyn, there's only so many pages in any of these sections, and there must have been a lot more you could have included. How did you decide what not to include?
So once we kind of had our team of authors assembled, we all just brainstormed topics, things we wanted included, and we have a lot of topics. Mm-hmm. So then each author kind of filtered it on their own, depending on, like Tracy said, if we could find credible sources and information about them. We kind of, you know, it's a 2018-2019 almanac, so we wanted it to be things that were kind of maybe a little bit more happening and now and modern, I guess, if we could. But we definitely have lots of leftover topics, so there's definitely the potential for another almanac.
Look for Almanac 2020.
Exactly.
What's your favorite thing that you included in the animals section? Because I love the animals section and all the pictures and the stories.
I think my favorite part of the animal section are all of the native animals that were included, because it's definitely a ton of fun to, you know, go to the zoo and visit elephants and things like that. But I think it's also really important for kids to know about what lives in their own backyard. And we have a lot of awesome wildlife here in Missouri. And so I think that was the most fun part for me, was just kind of being like, yeah, we have black bears, we have coyotes, we have bobcats, you know,
we have nine banded armadillos.
Yeah. I was focused on the carnivores, of course, but you know. Well, armadillos too, yes.
Yeah, I just saw my first armadillo by the side of the highway not too long ago, mm-hmm. and I guess I don't get out of Kansas City enough because I didn't even realize we had them.
If you drive to Arkansas, you'll for sure see them on the way. If you go southern Missouri, yeah, you'll see a lot of armadillos on the side of the road, sadly.
So I guess I'm curious from you, Andrea, what your favorite part of this book is.
There's so many amazing sections, but I really feel like the biography section is excellent. I feel like it's a great place to see in one place just the diversity, the innovation, the historical significance of a lot of different people who have ties to Missouri. So it's just a neat place to kind of see that, and I just think it's really well done.
One of the things I found myself being conscious of as I looked at this was whether it was a St. Louis-leaning Missouri story or a Kansas City-leaning. How did you navigate that?
We did. We really kind of paid attention to, and we knew the two cities were going to be have a lot of content. So besides kind of making sure there was a balance between Kansas City and St. Louis, we also tried to make sure there was plenty of information about the rural areas and highlighting some of the smaller towns and some of the mid-sized towns in the state.
I want to invite our listeners, if you want to share your favorite facts about Missouri, give us a call at 816-235-2888. Maybe you can stump our panel if you have a question. 816, they just all looked at each other nervously. 816-235-2888. One of the things you report, something I didn't know, and I've lived in Missouri almost 20 years, the first Olympics to come to the United States were in Missouri. Who can tell me about that? Please, Carolyn.
I actually did a research paper on these Olympics when I was in grade school, so I feel like I can talk about this. We had the Olympics in St. Louis in 1904 as part of the World's Fair, and they weren't that big of a deal, surprisingly. Now the Olympics are this huge international event, but in 1904 they were kind of a sideshow to the World's Fair. So very exciting, very cool, fun fact, but not the big event that it is today, but still kind of a fun thing to be
part of. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did I read this correctly? They were originally assigned to Chicago, but they just casually moved them to St. Louis?
Yeah, no big deal, right? Yeah, so they just casually moved them to St. Louis and just kind of included them with the festivities that were going on that year.
You know, I guess I wonder how do you expect kids will use this outside of classrooms? We talked about how teachers might use it and how it conforms to learning standards, but what's a kid going to do with this book?
I think just based on the look of it, it has that high interest appeal and the visual pieces. The pictures are really, I think, helpful. And one thing I really like about it is there's short snippets kind of introducing. So if you just kind of want to browse, I think kids will find things that they can just pull out. And then if they want to read more, they can kind of dig in. I would imagine it's one of those books that you'll see kids surrounding, you know, at a table, maybe standing around and pointing things out to each other, that kind of thing, kind of a social opportunity for them.
Tracy, you mentioned the Frank Lloyd Wright House. Were you responsible for the haunted sections of this book?
I was not.
Oh, okay. I want to ask who wrote the part about the haunted houses in Missouri? Someone who's not here.
Was that Barb? That might have been Barb, yeah. One of our editors who helped put it together, and did a great job of editing and
there's
probably
a whole
filling
page
in.
on a place called Epperson House on the UMKC campus.
Well, yes, I can speak about Epperson House because actually one of my books is called Kansas City Boo, and it's a children's book, and the character goes to five haunted places. Mm. And so in the process of bringing this book to Kansas City, I've been doing these library presentations at Mid-Continent Libraries about haunted Kansas City, and Alexis Bechtold, my partner in adventure, has been accompanying me, and she's a videographer, and we went to Epperson House and Belvoir Winery and Hotel Savoy, and so Epperson House at UMKC is known for its mysterious past and perhaps a ghost, Harriet Bars, who haunts it.
It's an old mansion, but it's used as offices now, right?
It's shuttered now. It was used as offices. It had a long history. It served as, I think it was education department, and I think there was a music, and then I think urban planning and architecture was the last department to use it. But
so now,
it's
now ghosts have it to themselves.
Shuttered. Yeah, you can walk up to it, but you can't actually go in. You know, it's still there.
What else are some of your favorite Kansas City elements of in this book? Does anything stand out to you?
Well, the fountains are definitely there and mentioned and kind of highlighted a little bit. So that's something.
As far as oddity goes, Excelsior Springs, I did not realize the spring water was reported to cure tuberculosis.
So people would go up to the Elms and, and get
cured. Right,
and
they're another haunted place, if we want to continue that theme. There are plenty of Kansas City, I'm trying to think, and the arts and architecture as well. The Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, of course, that's more modern, but that was definitely, I was excited to put that in that section.
There was a whole page on Walt Disney, who, of course, we associate with Kansas City, Andrea.
Right. So he was born in Marceline and spent some time in rural Missouri before he, kind of came to Kansas City and really went a lot further than that. So.
We have a caller who is an expert. Let's talk to Spencer in Kansas City. Hello, Spencer.
Hello. I heard the ghost in Epperson House one night about 2 a.m. I was alone in the building, and I heard about 3 organ notes about 2 a.m. And I confirmed I was the only one in there, and I did not go upstairs. I left the building, and then I saw a classmate coming in to work. And she was like, "What's wrong?" Because I had a look on my face, and I was like, "I just heard organ music." And she was like, "I'm leaving." And I was like, "Yeah, me too."
What were you doing in the building by yourself, Spencer?
It was Architectural and Urban Planning Studio.
Yeah.
So we had 24-hour access to the building at the time, and just working on some schoolwork.
Wow. Well, I appreciate your sharing the story. This is appropriate both for our Missouri Almanac and also with Halloween coming up. So thanks, Spencer.
All right, thank you. Wanted to share.
Appreciate it very much. You wrote about the oddities as well, or the mysteries. Is that right, Tracy?
Yes. So I focused mostly on the ones that so the Oddfellows, the Belvoir Winery, we're still on the haunted, but sort of mystery. We talked about some of the organizations like the Masons in St. Louis, the other mysteries. I'm trying to think. With me on the side. I did a lot of the history. The mystery was more of in the haunted. I realize now that there, in Cape Girardeau, apparently, there were aliens that landed, or according to the town lore, and that might make the next edition that we'll have to verify and check out and see if that could go into the mystery section. But
We
focused a little bit on, what's up with that, or the Limp Mansion in St. Louis, which also is rumored to be haunted.
Carolyn, you also wrote the section on food and farming, is that right?
I did the farm section. There's a section called Just Eat It, which is all about regional foods and specialties, but I did the farm section.
Which I have to say, I would have liked to see a bit more play for Kansas City barbecue in that section. Yeah. Okay.
We'll accept that criticism from me.
All right. Very good. A lot of St. Louis foods in there. But tell me about farming. I mean, we in the Kansas City, the area, we have our listening area goes out into some of that farming community. Mm-hmm. What are Kansas City's biggest crops?
Well, I would say that farming for me was a bit more of a challenge than the animal section. I'm no farming expert, but mm-hmm. I did learn a lot about, the main crops that are grown in Missouri and what they're used for.
What are they?
We've got soybeans. That's a big one. Corn, of course, but I did learn that most of our corn goes toward feeding animals. It's not what we're barbecuing on summer nights. Wheat, of course, is another one that we have a lot of. We did try to, like we talked about, keep this section sort of up to date with what's going on in the farming world as far as including organic farms and small family farms, but also including Monsanto and talking a little bit about what's the best way to go. These large, mm-hmm. Scientific Monsanto-run farms or the small organic farms, and get kids thinking about that.
And that's a good point. The book isn't just a list of fun facts. It does raise some of the issues that are facing Missouri mm-hmm. as well. And there's also puzzles. There's things for kids to actually fill in, to write in the book. Is that important in a book like this, Andrea?
I think it just helps draw kids into things that they're interested in and maybe gives them a chance to do something with the information that they've learned. I think it'll kind of stick a little better and maybe pique their interest to go deeper in other ways.
All right. This may be one of those stump the panel calls, but here's Jim in Kansas City. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
What's your question for our guests today, the authors of the Missouri Almanac? Jim, are you there? Go ahead.
Yes, I'm here. there's a street in Kansas City, it's Snye Bar Road. And so I did a little research into that because I also used to drive across, going out I-70, you cross like the east branch of Snye Bar Creek. And so I began putting two to two together and realized that Snye Bar Farm, which used to be out near Oak Grove and Green Valley, belonged to William Rockhill Nelson. And some of the research I did, I came across a piece of information that that farm out there that belonged to him used to do some experimental things, but and people from around the world would come to visit that farm to see what they were doing. But what exactly they were doing, I never found any information on. But I just thought it was interesting that Snye Bar Road used to be the road that went from Oak Hall in Kansas City to his farm out there in Oak Grove. But in any case, if you found any information about what William Rockhill Nelson's farm was doing out there in the early 20th century that attracted attention, I'd be interested to hear it.
All right, Jim, thanks for the call. Anyone know anything more about William Rockhill Nelson and his farm?
I do not.
No.
But I think I should add that to the mystery section for the next time.
Write it down. Sounds good.
Our crack producer, Danny Alexander, has supplied some information that Nelson actually purchased a shorthorn breeding cattle and began a program of improving the variety of animal that would produce a better beef yield. So there you go. That's what William Rockhill Nelson was about, as he tried to develop new medicines and new vaccines and tried to improve agricultural sciences in general. So there you go. We are out of time, but I really am grateful for all of you guys taking the time. This book is in the process of being rolled out. You're going to do some appearances in early 2018 at local libraries. Is that right,
Tracy? That's correct.
So look for that, Mid-Continent Libraries, right?
Yes, in February and March, and hopefully a few other locations as well.
Well, thank you so much. That's Tracy Angel, Carolyn Miller, and Andrea Sumi, authors of the Missouri Almanac 2018-19 from Reedy Press out of St. Louis. Thank you guys so much for coming.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you for having us.
Really appreciate you being here. We hope that that you will listen again on Monday to the program. Former attorney, now best-selling author, John Grisham will introduce his latest legal thriller, and Steve Kraske will be back in this chair. Don't forget, our podcasts and previous programs are at kcur.org/uptodate, and you can find us on Twitter, at @KCURUpToDate. I'm at PTS Brian. You can also follow KCUR on Facebook. The great Bobby Watson composed that theme music you're hearing, and we had help this week from Chris Pruitt, Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date